Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'd like to thank the UCSF group once again for the opportunity to be here. I think this is really a terrific meeting and it's really an honor. So I was asked to talk a little bit about risk assessment in the CLI patient and asking the question, who is likely to benefit from revascularization and who is not? So, you know, ultimately, the photo I have there, it's a little bit about trying to tell the future. And I think sometimes it can be pretty easy. So this is an 89-year-old patient I saw about a week ago. Patient was non-ambulatory, had multiple failed intervention in the past, and had 4-foot and heel gangrene. And I think that was pretty simple. I don't think that patient would benefit from a revascularization, and I think most people would support that judgment. But more often than not, it's not so easy. And this was a patient from about a year ago, 77-year-old, dialysis-dependent, has tissue loss, had a CABG 2 years prior where they used the ipsilateral greater saphenous vein, did live at home independently, and had the contralateral greater saphenous vein present. So I evaluated the patient, talked with the patient. We obtained an arteriogram with an eye towards revascularization. That patient had mild iliac and common femoral artery disease, an occluded SFA and popliteal segment, with reconstitution of the anterior tibial artery with direct runoff to the foot. So I thought it was reasonable to proceed, and we did a FEM-AT bypass and got what I thought was a very nice result. Was able to do a transmetatarsal amputation that initially looked like it was healing well, but unfortunately eventually presented to clinic looking like this with an associated infection. So I debrided that foot, wasn't very happy with the result, and ultimately evolved to this outcome. So 7.5 months out from a revascularization surgery, ended up with a below knee amputation. Clearly in my mind and the patient's mind, not an optimal outcome. So what this talk really is about is trying to identify that patient up front before you've spent 7.5 months trying to get them ultimately to a below knee amputation. So it's really about predicting outcomes. And we talk about risk stratification, and that's something that's been my main interest. And ultimately, the goal there is to improve decision making. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about the work we've done trying to do that in patients with critical limb ischemia. So I think most would agree that critical limb ischemia is associated with a very high risk of cardiovascular events that include major limb loss, myocardial infarction, stroke, and death. And you heard debates today talking about the different treatment strategy, and while open surgical bypass traditionally has been the gold standard method for revascularization, there are numerous alternative treatment strategies that have evolved and are beginning to play more and more prominent roles, endovascular techniques, primary amputation, and conservative management. So how can we decide up front? So our goal was to develop and validate a prognostic risk index for patients with CLI that are being considered for one of these revascularization strategies. So the study design for the first study I want to tell you about was a retrospective review of 3 prospectively collected databases where we derived and then validated a risk prediction model. The data sources we used initially were PREVENT-3, 1,400 patients from 83 hospitals, all with CLI. We then created an external validation cohort, which were 716 patients from 3 hospitals in the United States. And then ultimately, we used the Vascular Surgery Group of New England data set with about 1,166 critical limb ischemia patients. Our first step was to take the PREVENT-3 cohort and divide it into a derivation set and a validation set. So we took those 1,400 patients and we assigned 2/3 of them to this derivation set, so to create a risk prediction model, and then 1/3 we reserved for validation of that risk prediction model. So we created a multivariable model, and then, as has been done in many studies, we converted it to a standard integer score. I think what's a little bit unique is then we tried to be pretty rigorous about the validation. So we validated it internally, first in the P3 validation set, then externally in that external multicenter cohort, then we validated again in the VSGNE, and then recently it was validated in a cohort from Finland. So let me show you that a little bit. This was the model that ultimately was yielded after, you know, what we thought was pretty rigorous statistical analysis showing that dialysis, tissue loss, advanced age, anemia, and a history of advanced CAD defined as previous revascularization, either with CABG or with PTCI, were all independent predictors. We then took the beta coefficients from that model, and again, as has been done with standardized methodology, we created an integer score. And that allowed us to look at each patient within each of these cohorts and assign them a value. So we just scored each one of them with a risk score. Then we did some threshold analysis, and we could calculate their amputation-free survival at 1 year and classify them into a low-risk group, somewhere in the 80% range, a medium-risk group, and then a very high-risk group, as Dr. Conti alluded to earlier in his presentation. And we found that these groups actually discriminated quite well, so showing that graphically, you can see with the Kaplan-Meier curves and the histogram, that we had a low-risk group if they had less than 3 points with an 86% amputation-free survival 1 year, a medium-risk group about 73%, and then a high-risk group that had a less than 50% chance of amputation-free survival at 1 year. So with this scorecard, you could very simply in your office be able to quickly put patients in a bucket which determined their risk of amputation-free survival with a bypass. We then went ahead and tried to validate that. So first, we compared our derivation set results to our internal validation set. And I think you can see very well that there was good correlation, 86 versus 88% for the low risk, 73 versus 64% for medium risk, and 45% versus 45% for the high-risk groups. We then went ahead and did that again with our external validation cohort. And again, this was from the Brigham, University of South Florida, and Florida State. And you can see, again, very good correlation both on the Kaplan-Meier curves and then the absolute values on the histogram. We then did it with the VSGNE data set and, again, showed very good correlation, 86 versus 86, 73 versus 74, and 45 versus 56. And I think what was interesting about this comparison with the VSGNE group is that when you look at the characteristics of the patients, they were dramatically different. So all those p-values being significant, showing that there were differences between the cohorts in their demographics, their medication usage, their risk factors, and their surgical characteristics. Yet again, when you put all of these patients and compared them using this risk prediction model, it performed very well, arguing for good generalizability. Most recently, this was applied in a cohort from Finland, and again showed very good discrimination with very similar results. So I think it is generalizable. So we concluded in this study that the P3 risk score is easily used at initial presentation using five simple dichotomous variables. Is the patient dialysis dependent? Do they have tissue loss on presentation? Is the hematocrit less than or equal to 30? Are they age older than 75? And do they have a history of advanced CAD? So we feel that it's generalizable based on the validation. And we believe that the P3 risk score is a useful clinical tool for decision planning. But really, the question comes back to, does it allow us to answer the question, who is likely to benefit from revascularization and who is not? And unfortunately, I don't think the answer is yes. It helps, and it gives you some information on being able to have an informed discussion with the patient about what their outcome would be, specifically with regards to amputation-free survival. But there are a lot of other outcomes, as Dr. Andrus alluded to, that certainly matter as well. So I want to tell you a little bit about some additional work we've done using the VSGNE data set, trying to better understand what factors affect outcomes and how we can predict this in advance when meeting a patient and discussing treatment strategies. So I'm going to talk about four of the models that I was involved with creating with some other very talented co-authors. Phil Goodney's been very involved with this, Brian Nolan, Jess Simons. And we looked at amputation or graft occlusion at 1 year, death at 1 year, ambulation status at 1 year, trying to get a little more at the functional status, and then this concept of clinical failure where a patient, despite having a patent graft at 1 year, still does not have resolution of their symptoms. So looking specifically at the factors associated with amputation or graft occlusion, you can see that we found on the final models that patients that were of very young age, that were non-ambulatory, dialysis dependent, had diabetes, had critical limb ischemia as their presenting diagnosis, needed spliced veins, and had tarsal targets or were residing in nursing homes, had poorer outcomes. And when we looked at patients with no risk factors, they had amputation rates less than 1% at 1 year. But patients with more than three of these risk factors had a nearly 30% chance of suffering amputation. When we looked at factors associated with death, we saw that CHF, diabetes, critical limb ischemia, absence of a single segment greater saphenous vein, age over 80, dialysis, and urgency of the procedure were all independent predictors. And in this situation, we found that patients with no risk factors had a one-year death rate less than 5%, whereas patients with greater than three risk factors had a 28% chance of dying within one year. We then looked at ambulation status, and not surprisingly found that their preoperative ambulatory status was an independent predictor, their age, whether they were in a nursing home, and some of their postoperative events. So the likelihood of non-ambulatory status at 1 year was less than 5% in patients with no risk factors and up to about 50% in patients that had greater than three. The last model I'll show you, this was just looking at this concept of failure to achieve clinical improvement despite graft patency. And here we saw that if they'd had a history of a revascularization, insulin-dependent diabetes, dialysis dependence, or needing assistance with ambulation or lack of independent ambulation, that they were at higher risk. And this was not an insignificant number. So after lower extremity bypass for CLI in this study, 10% of the patients with a patent graft did not achieve clinical improvement at 1 year. So how do you really put all this together? I think it's challenging. And, you know, basically what we do as clinicians is we start looking at a patient and we think about what outcomes are meaningful to them. And you can look at amputation-free survival at 1 year as one of those outcomes and see that these are the risk factors that may predict failure. But then you start throwing in enough other things and see how they overlap. So you look at survival at 1 year and you see that there are some other factors that the patient may have. Then you start putting in ambulation and seeing how those relate and interact. And then maybe you look at this concept of clinical failure or whether they are able to ambulate at 1 year. And then you start sort of running out, at least of my sort of ability on PowerPoint to represent this. But I think that's what we're doing as clinicians, trying to better understand how all these factors interact. So I think when you ask the question, who is likely to benefit from revascularization and who is not, the answer is that we really lack validated instruments at this time to accurately answer that question. And it really does have to be an individualized decision. And all we can do is try to best inform that decision with the available data that we have. I think we need to start looking at more novel endpoints that are more function-related. And while we can predict some specific outcomes at specific time points with relative accuracy, we often can't with other outcomes that are very meaningful to a patient. So the best we can do is try to use available data to help inform patient and physician decision-making. So we are trying to tell the future, and I think we're not as good at it yet as we'd like to be. I'm going to just kind of close with one quick anecdote from when I had the opportunity to do my general surgery residency here in California, and it's fun to be back. And as I was flying here, I was kind of thinking about my experience there, and I remembered one very poignant experience, and that was on a weekend off. I went up to Mount Shasta, which is pretty close by, and my girlfriend at the time and now wife, we climbed to the top. And then when we got down, we got back to our campsite, and we were on this glacier, and we were talking to this man that had basically dusted us. So he was a 52-year-old guy, and he got down. He was already cleaning up his camp when we were coming down. And I remember talking to him mainly because when I looked over at his tent, I saw this, and I was pretty struck by that. So 52-year-old, you know, at that time I was at a good fighting age of around 28, 26, and he had really kind of lapped us up this mountain. So I went to talk to him, and I remember being struck by the fact that he was telling me he was a poorly controlled diabetic. He had had several bypasses and several sort of interventions on his feet, not endovascular interventions, but amputations. And then ultimately, 2 years into that experience, had this below-knee amputation. And he really said to me that that was the most meaningful procedure and interaction he had had with any of his physicians because it allowed him to resume his activity. So certainly there are patients that will benefit from primary amputation. And I think really what we have to strive for is doing a better job of identifying those patients up front. Thanks again for the opportunity to be here, and I appreciate your kind attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.